Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is Episode 14, Zapruder, Part 6. Yes, I can't believe it. We ended up doing 6 parts to the Zapruder film. I know it was a big wander, but I hope it was worth it. I know on my end it was. This is absolutely a fascinating subject. You know, the Zapruder film has had a dual identity since the very beginning. One, as a core and central piece of evidence in the JFK case, and then, of course, its place as a commercial asset that made the Zapruder family rich and incited all sorts of social, legal, and ethical controversies as a result of it. It even managed to get itself positioned to be in potentially a landmark copyright case. That's a full life for a 26-second film. Well, at the end of Part 5, we left off just as the Zapruder family was getting the film back for a whopping $1. It would be in their hands from 1975 all the way to 1999. And we'll tell the rest of the story in this final part of the Zapruder series as the film makes its way back home. So, without further ado, let's listen to Episode 14, Zapruder, Part 6. Life was acutely aware of the criticisms they were subjected to during the course of their ownership of the Zapruder film. Criticisms over the fact that the film was not widely available for the public to see and for serious assassination researchers to view. And so, as part of the overall deal to transfer the film, Life donated to the federal government a set of 35mm color transparencies for each frame in the film. These transparencies were made from the first generation copy of the Zapruder film and thus were of the highest quality. The Zapruders agreed to this, provided that there were still limitations on seeing these as well. The Zapruders needed assurances that this wouldn't impinge on the commercial value of their ownership. The slides then would be available at the National Archives for viewing only at that location. Well, the Zapruders were taking back ownership of the film, and they had gotten it for the nominal price of $1. But they realized they had no expertise or even facility for storing or preserving such a film as an artifact. As a result, they began to arrange a deal with the National Archives to become custodian of the original film, even though the government agency would not be the owner. In a moment, we're going to understand why possession is 9/10 of the law, as the old saying goes. Interestingly enough, the Zapruder family would not deliver the film to the archives until almost 3 years later, after the details of the custodial deal were completely worked out and signed. There were strict provisions in that deal that allowed for a controlled review of the original on the premises and only at the direction of the Zapruder estate. By that time, the Zapruder estate was now firmly back in control of the film. Abraham Zapruder's estate was now being administrated by Abraham's son, Henry. Henry was a tax attorney living in Washington, D.C., close to all the action around the film. The House Select Committee on Assassinations brought new attention to the film, and we will get to the HSCA story in a later episode in the podcast series. After the HSCA wound down, again, the Zapruder film took a nice siesta and was once again tucked away at the National Archives. And occasionally, an exalted individual got to take a look at it. Things were kind of sleepy again for the film until the late 1980s. In 1988, two private citizens teamed up on a project to gain access to the film. Chip Selby, who was a graduate student in the middle of completing a video documentary on the single bullet theory, and Harold Weisberg, who, as I mentioned before, was one of the most respected assassination researchers and was still going strong. The two were seeking, among other things, 35mm color prints of each of the frames in the movie, and prints made from the original film. At first, they directed their inquiries to the National Archives, as they were aware that the original film was being kept in custody there. The archives responded that their request could be fulfilled, and the approximate cost of the request would be a paltry $1,300. But before that request could be fulfilled, it would have to be approved by LMH, which was the name of the LLC that the Zapruders had transferred ownership of the Zapruder film itself to after it was returned to them individually as heirs. Incidentally, the name LMH was derived from the first letter of the first name of each of the three Zapruder heirs. Abraham Zapruder's son Henry was now in charge of LMH's affairs. Soon, correspondence began between the two researchers and Henry Zapruder. Ultimately, while communications went back and forth, Henry never provided an approval to the researchers or even a definitive answer from their perspective. Part of that may have been a result of the fact that their request expanded at some point to a broader use of the movie in a documentary, and the price he quoted for licensing rights was not acceptable. And so it became a point of further discussion that Henry chose not to pursue, or at least he became distracted, or maybe just plain uninterested. No one really knows why Henry didn't answer back, but certainly his non-responsiveness led to the filing of civil litigation against LMH by the researchers. Weisberg and Selby filed suit against LMH and defendants in United States District Court for the District of Columbia and brought the suit before Judge Thomas Pennefield Jackson. Plaintiffs were represented by James Lazar. The suit first and foremost asked for injunctive relief, requesting that the court step in and order Zapruder to provide copies of the film to be used by the plaintiffs in their research project. The causes of action attacked the Copyright Act, its fair use, and whether the copyright itself had violated the Constitution. This went to the heart of the matter as it related to the film as a piece of evidence. There were four key copyright issues set forth in the case. In the end, they used all sorts of examples in the court case to make their points around copyright, including a few interesting aspects of it. For example, they argued the fact that because Zapruder never brought suit against ABC in the original Geraldo Rivera show, and also that Zapruder did not go after Robert Groden for using certain unauthorized aspects of the Zapruder film in his own best-selling book, that these examples should be key factors in concluding that the Zapruders had not enforced the existing copyright. They also brought up the mountain of showings on local TV stations of clips of the film that were not compensated for and where there was no action taken around copyright infringement. Also presented was the clear existence of a massive level of unauthorized bootleg copies that had been sold in the marketplace with no copyright enforcement action. Lazar argued that LMH engaged in a massive failure to enforce the copyright using all of these various examples, and that such non-action basically constituted abandonment of the copyright itself, with the consequence that the film was now in the public domain. The minutiae of the trial and the arguments even got down into the circulation and publication of parts of the film with a copyright symbol that contained a year next to the symbol that was more than 1 year old, with Lazar maintaining that such stale dates next to the copyright mark meant that the copyright had not been properly communicated to users. Lazar also argued the overriding point of the litigation, and that was that the film, regardless of all of these other claims, should be in the public realm because it was simply in the public interest for it to be there. Lazar, in his closing argument, delivered a powerful message to the judge, and I quote it as follows. At issue in this case is whether one man, acting for the alleged copyright owner of perhaps the most vital piece of documentary evidence in the history of the United States, is to be allowed to use the Copyright Act to dictate what ideas and information the public may receive concerning the president's assassination and what evidence scholars and researchers may study. It was a powerful statement for the judge to hear before rendering his decision. Certainly, the technical issues around the copyright were designed to unstick the boat from the sandbar, so to speak, but they were really only a means to an end. Still, though, the copyright argument was significant, and this case might go all the way to the Supreme Court. It was a bit of a high-stakes gamble for both parties. Weisberg, Selby, and Lazar were trying to set this up to free the film for all of the American people, but the approach they had taken seemingly had larger looming ramifications for all of American commerce when it came to resolving the core copyright issues. In the end, the judge was not forced to rule on any of these key matters around copyright, as the parties came together and made a decision to settle the lawsuit privately out of court. The terms of the arrangement were kept confidential. The researchers gained access to the film and went on to, among other things, produce an award-winning documentary about the JFK assassination. Once more, the Zapruder film avoided being torn from the hands of its commercial owners. The life of the Zapruder film as a major commercial asset was, nevertheless, nearing its end, regardless of all that had just happened in the Weisberg suit. More than anything, the Weisberg case just added to the conclusion that this issue around the film as evidence had to be settled once and for all by the government. The next big event for the film is one that most of us know. It was the movie JFK, starring Kevin Costner and directed by Oliver Stone. The Zapruder estate typically sold limited rights to use the film in projects for a purported price of between $40,000 and $80,000. And that's the amount rumored to have been charged to Stone for use in the JFK movie. Oliver Stone's JFK film reignited the public. It was a new generation that was now taking a renewed interest in the unsolved mystery of the assassination. This event was to launch the Zapruder film on the last leg of its roller coaster ride through history. In 1992, our government finally passed a public law known as the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Act of 1992. The act created the Assassination Records Review Board, or ARRB. This act brought a final, definitive answer on the government's right to hold any and all property related to the assassination. The act itself firmly declares that when the ARRB determines that a piece of evidence constitutes part of the record related to the assassination, they have the power to transfer such items to the National Archives. More importantly, there was a narrow provision of this new act, Section 11A, that had significant teeth to it. It took precedent over any existing law or judicial decision or construance of any common law or common law doctrine that would otherwise prohibit such a transmission. Items of evidence, such as the Zapruder film, fall under the jurisdiction of these provisions. In effect, it was to nullify by statute any argument that anyone can make in a court of law regarding the transference of records and evidence to the National Archives related to the assassination. Simply put, it now gave the federal government the right to seize the Zapruder film from the Zapruder family. Initially, the Zapruders did not seem concerned about this provision of the new law. That was until one day, curiously, out of the blue, a representative of LMH showed up at the National Archives, requesting access to the film with the intention of taking it off the premises. And he wanted the approval and the possession change to take place before the close of business that day. after a series of communications back and forth that included the second in command at the National Archives and a lawyer at the Justice Department, the government made a decision that the new law applied, and that until the ARRB opined on whether the Zapruder film was going to be taken, it would not be physically provided back to the Zapruders. The LMH representative left the National Archives empty-handed that day and not in a very good mood. This is another great example of where possession really was 9/10 of the law. The government had physical control of the Zapruder film as a result of its custody agreement with the Zapruders and now used it to their advantage. The ARRB eventually met and formally concluded that the Zapruder film was indeed a record that was covered under the new act and therefore authorized the board to seize the film. The board debated comprehensively the various views on the topic, asking whether they should simply seize the film for no compensation under the new narrow provisions that would allow them to do so, or whether it was more appropriate to work with the Zapruder family to retain the film in exchange for some form of compensation. There was a spirited view on both sides of the argument, some arguing for seizure with no compensation, but ultimately the government decided that it would negotiate and make some form of payment to the Zapruder family for the taking of the film. On August 1, 1998, the ARRB voted unanimously to ensure that the film be transferred to the federal government, but oddly enough left transfer of the copyright itself out of their official resolution, instead simply focusing on transfer of the actual film itself. Clearly a technical oversight, or so folks thought. In the few months prior to the scheduled transfer on August 1, 1998, the Department of Justice began to negotiate with the Zapruder family regarding compensation for the film. Given the high-profile politics around the entire circumstance and the economic stakes involved, the Zapruders hired a prominent Washington attorney, Robert S. Bennett, to promote their own interests. Originally, the Zapruders asked the government to pay them $18.5 million for the film, including the copyright, but the Department of Justice rejected that as too high of a figure for the government to pay. The original counteroffer from the government was $750,000, and with a suggestion that the bid could go as high as $3 million. In the meantime, the government also went through a process to revalidate the authenticity of the film, employing an expert named Roland Zavada, who was a retired Kodak employee. His firm validated the authenticity of the film for the government. The deadline set by the ARRB for transferring the film was fast approaching, and the government and the Zapruder family were far apart when it came to agreeing on a price for the film. As a result, the parties ended up signing a binding arbitration agreement. For those of us who do a lot of contract work, the arbitration panel was a typical structure. It consisted of three arbitrators, with the government choosing one arbitrator, LMH choosing one arbitrator, and then the two arbitrators getting together to choose the third arbitrator. This panel of three arbitrators would ultimately determine the final compensation to be paid to the Zapruder family. The family was well represented during all of this and took additional legal action, filing two related civil suits simultaneously that were then subject to a legal stay pending the outcome of the arbitration proceedings. As you might expect, one of the suits dealt with the core question of the government's legal right to seize the film in the first place. The second suit related to the idea of determining just compensation if the government was successful in their actions to seize the film. Still, in all of this, the government announced that the copyright would remain in the hands of LMH. This was mind-boggling, especially at these proposed rates of compensation for the Zapruder family. In the end, on August 3, 1999, the arbitration panel announced that they had reached an agreement and that they would pay the Zapruder family $16 million for the taking of the film. and that the Zapruder family would still retain the copyright. All the government really got for their $16 million at this point was ownership of the film that was already in their possession. Oh, I guess, and fair use of the film under the Copyright Act. The amount paid to the Zapruders was a shock to many. The government's appraisers had placed the value of the film somewhere between $784,000 and $1.8 million. The government appraisers attempted to use, among other things, an income approach to the valuation, a common approach that you might see in many valuation circumstances. But their data and their approach had flaws from the start. For example, in one calculation, they used a multiple of income, taking only the original $150,000 payment, but then conveniently leaving off the value of half of the gross receipts that the Zapruder family had earned throughout the contract period with Life. Going the other way, the LMH appraisers made arguments that the value was somewhere between $25 and $40 million or so, and they also argued that the federal steps to seize the film had already cost LMH more than $10 million or maybe even more. They even had an auction house expert testify that the film's unique character might have been worth somewhere between $50 and $75 million. That figure was based on some of the more recent sale of esoteric collector's items. They cited the Codex of Leonardo da Vinci that was recently purchased for $30 million by the wealthy entrepreneur Bill Gates. The saga was nearing the end, and again, the Zapruder family was getting more wealthy once again as a result of that 26-second movie that Abraham Zapruder took that Friday in Dallas. Their skilled lawyers had managed to negotiate an incredible deal, which also allowed the family to retain the copyright to the film. But enough was enough. It was time to put the film and all of its parts in the appropriate hands. So in one final and important step, LMH and the Zapruder family transferred ownership of the film's copyright to the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, a nonprofit organization that continues to this day to run the museum that is now a big part of the old Texas Schoolbook Depository, and which also preserves the history of the JFK assassination. In a broader sense, the museum continues to help our country better understand what really happened that day in Dallas and to heal a wound that is still open to this day. Whether you believe in faith or fate or karma, had it not been for Abraham Zapruder, the film itself may have never been shot in the first place. And whatever his motivations were once the film was made, good, bad, or indifferent, his courage on the day of the assassination guarded against the film falling into the deep abyss. Without Abraham Zapruder, there simply would be no Zapruder film. Without a Zapruder film, the narrative of the Warren Commission may have pranced right through the American psyche with manageable doubts attached to it. The film really changed it all. The truth that accompanied this film deserves much of the credit in exposing a number of the untruths told by the government in the Kennedy assassination story. For the listeners of our podcast, and you yourself, the jury, it's been another long day. Let's head home and watch the sunset. It surely will be followed by the sunrise of another day. Thank you for listening to episode 14 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.